the End User, episode 168 for Tuesday, April 22nd, Waterproof Shark Week. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. And not a whole lot futuristic going on this week, Chris, but we have some product reviews, some phones and tablets that we already heard about, but now we've got the down low on them. So should we start talking about the Sony Xperia Z2 tablet and phone?
Yeah, it was we can get into it, but it's a funny week this week to contrast last week. Last week was so frenetic for the podcast, and this week we'll be able to take it a little easy, I guess. So, yeah, let's get into it. They've released Sony is releasing two devices, which are confusingly named the same thing. One is a tablet, one is a phone. And I got to say, when I first looked at this news, I thought, well, okay, it's another Android tablet. Who cares? But now that I kind of look at it, I'm kind of liking it. So the Sony Xperia Z2 tablet is a waterproof 10.1-inch 1080p tablet with 16 or 32 gigs of storage, an 8-megapixel camera, and 3 gig of RAM. It's got a 2.3 gigahertz quad core chip and the latest Android 4.4 KitKat. So, as far as I can see from those from the specs, it looks like a pretty respectable device.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It looks like they put a lot of effort into making a really good screen for this, and they're saying that it is the slimmest and lightest waterproof tablet, which I don't have a hard time believing.
Yeah, and just looking at the design of the thing, I think it's pretty nice looking. You know, it's a plain black slab, which I've always liked the kind of plain, nondescript gadgets. There's something subtly nice about something that's not completely over-designed and something that's just kind of simple and gets out of the way and brings the content on the screen to you. You know what I mean?
I get a kick out of like when it's off and it's just a completely black slab. There's no identifying features whatsoever. And then all of a sudden you turn it on and it's this interactive window into another world. I think that's really cool. It's very futurist.
Yeah. So, you know, having not used it and having only seen the announcement, I think this is a pretty big win for Sony. It hasn't been getting a whole lot of press around, but I think it looks quite competent. So that is going to be available for $500 on Star Wars Day. And for the uninitiated, that is May the 4th.
Right. And the tablet will be available in the U.S., but the Xperia Z2 phone is only going to be launching in the U.K. and Canada. Or no, I'm sorry, a whole bunch of other countries besides that, but not the U.S.
Right, just not here. So for once, we're on the other side of the looking glass, aren't we?
Well, when it comes to the phone, but we can get the tablet.
Right. Yeah, and so this is in kind of the same vein. They've got some similar design language between the two. This is a black slab phone. It's a 5.2-inch 1080p screen with 16 gigs of storage, a 20-megapixel camera. In the same vein, it's kind of nice in its plainness. So it's not going to hold a candle to the HTC One M8, I don't think. But it's not a long way off from that phone. Although I'd still put the One M8 on top of the Android pack for the moment.
Yeah, the original HTC One was a very good phone, and the M8 appears to just be an improvement. But it's worth noting that the Xperia Z2 phone is also waterproof and dustproof.
Right. And this is a trend that we're seeing now, and I like it.
Especially from Sony. They've been trying to do this on all of their flagships.
Yeah, if you happen to get your phone wet or it happens to rain outside, the phone should not break. It's something we've had to accept for a long time, but it really, when you think about it, it really just shouldn't be the case. They should be at least a little bit more durable than that.
Yeah, you shouldn't have to worry about the phone dying if it's in your pocket and it's raining outside.
Yeah, you really shouldn't have to worry about that kind of thing. Canadian Geek in the chat room there brings up a good point. He says, waterproof. How waterproof is it? Can I go deep sea diving with it? And I guess that applies to both the tablet and the phone that we're talking about. And that's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember decades ago when you would get watches that were waterproof, they would tell you just exactly how waterproof it was rated to be, either in level of meters below surface or in atmospheres that it's rated to feel. But nowadays with modern electronics, they just say, well, it's kind of waterproof, or it's pretty waterproof, or it's very waterproof, but they don't tell you what you can do with it. Maybe they just don't want to be liable for those exact specifications. But I'm guessing it's splash waterproof and not submergent waterproof.
Yeah, yeah, and that seems reasonable. If you go diving with this, then when you return to the surface too quickly, it forms nitrogen bubbles in the circuits, and then it's going to break, so you don't want that.
Wow, I didn't realize phones could get the bends, too.
No, they can't. I'm being goofy, but... like I said, I really like the notion of these kind of gadgets at least being splash and rain proof, right?
Absolutely.
That's what we're talking about, and that's what it should be, and I hope that most devices going forward, now that we've kind of figured out the form factor and the chip involved in it, we've kind of gotten to a point where all these things are awesome. There's really no slowness to be had anymore these days. And I think maybe we can start to looking at ruggedizing them a little bit without getting them to be too ridiculously large, you know?
Right. Well, on that topic, we also have a full review from The Verge of the new Samsung Galaxy S5. Now, we already talked about this phone, but it's just starting to hit the shelves here in the U.S. And they've got a pretty great review. Apparently, the Galaxy S5 is also somewhat splash proof.
Yeah, again, you notice a theme cropping up here, at least for this week. It's waterproof week. It's kind of like shark proof, but instead it's waterproofing on phones.
Nice.
So yeah, we talked about this previously on the End User, and I think having not used the phone, our kind of initial impressions held up, but it seems to be a competent device that is not the best on the market, but is going to appeal in a big way to the kind of mass market of people who are going to buy this phone. And for the people who are following technology blogs and the like, it's probably not going to be the phone for them, but it's going to have a serious mass appeal. So again, you stack it up against the HTC One M8, and it falls a little bit short. But it's going to be massively popular. I can tell you that much right now.
Yeah, what I've been really surprised about Samsung's Galaxy flagship phones is the S3 was a clear improvement in pretty much every way on the 1 and the 2. But from the 3 to the 4 to the 5, at least in terms of design and ergonomics, they've kind of been lateral moves. I mean, Samsung is just trying too hard at this point to make a gigantic phone with everything in it. And they're not really improving the look or feel of these phones.
Yeah, it's just not something they're going for. Again, I think what they're trying to get at is good enough. And I think we've gotten to a point where just about any phone on the market that's in the mid and top tiers of the market is going to be a pretty darn good phone. It's matured in a way that it just wasn't a few years ago. And I think there's only so much you can do to differentiate yourself from your competitors.
Yeah, I guess HTC and Apple and Motorola are the ones trying to go for a catchier design, and Samsung is just making basic, thin, large phones that have everything you could possibly want in them.
Yeah, so I would like them to step up their design game, if nothing else. I feel like the industrial design on the phone is still a little bit lacking. But, I mean, as far as a device that you use that performs tasks, it looks to be very good at what it's doing. And, you know, not the most refined thing in the world, but again, most top-end phones these days are gonna do you well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But would you still pick the HTC One M8 if you were looking at an Android phone?
Yeah, that would probably be my choice at the moment. And, you know, it varies. depending on what people want. You know, it varies a little bit, but that would just be my knee-jerk preference for the moment.
I'm not sure what I would do. I would have to get my hands on them.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'd have to get a little more in depth and actually use them to really make that call. So another call that has to be made is the call on whether Aereo, the company that provides over the internet live TV programming, whether or not they're legal.
Right. So the reason this is news again is because the case of Aereo versus the broadcast networks that are trying to sue it is now going to be heard by the Supreme Court.
Right. So this is the day, and that's tomorrow. That's April 22nd, that we will know whether or not they're legal or not. So this has some precedent for the industry. So right now what they're doing is they have one antenna per customer. And they're saying, well, it's legal for us to rent this antenna to our customers and not pay any additional licensing fee because all we're doing is renting that antenna and it's one per customer. And that is completely within the law. That's their argument. And probably rightly so, TV industry, as it were, they're not liking that because they want to get their licensing fees. So I think Aereo has been clever to design their business in a way that is legal to the letter of the law, as far as we can see. But I don't know if that will be seen as being legal to the letter of the law or if it's just a cheap hack and that will... that Aereo's business model won't work because they, in fact, in reality, do owe licensing fees. You know what I mean?
Right. And so the problem is not the antennas themselves. That's all pretty much clear cut. They are allowed to build these antennas and then assign one antenna to each customer. It's the problem of what they're doing with the content between... the broadcast signal reaching the antenna and the stream going to each of their customers. So they do a little bit of data manipulation in their own cloud, and there's a delay of a few seconds, and you can also get recorded programs streamed to you. So there's interest on both sides, and obviously there is a legal question here that the Supreme Court has decided to weigh in on. And so I'm hoping that they come down on the side of innovation as opposed to the side of licensing fees. But I'm not sure which way they're going to go.
Yeah, it's hard to say. This is good, but this is going to set us up for the future of at least this type of television, you know, the local network kind of television. So I could see if Aereo does win, I could see some other companies looking to shirk the licensing fees, the rebroadcasting or retransmission fees, and trying to do something very similar. So the future of this class of broadcast is kind of hanging in the balance. I'd agree. I'd side with Aereo on this one because I think Aereo giving consumers the ability to consume Aereo cheaply and they still have the advertisements in their feeds. I just don't see that there's much wrong with that. You know, you're renting an antenna. They are keeping the advertisements and giving it to the consumer at a small charge. And I'm not sure I see much wrong with that. But obviously, the way the law works is not my gut feeling, right? So we're gonna find out tomorrow, and we'll see if anybody reacts to that, depending on which way it goes.
That's right. So we'll come back to that next week.
Yes, we will. We'll see if any of the higher execs have anything to say about it afterwards, too. It should be interesting. All right, well, with that, should we turn on our afterburners? Do you have your seatbelt securely fastened?
Yes, seatbelt is fastened. Let's do it.
All right.
AT&T has announced 100 cities where they might bring gigabit internet connection through their fiber optic network. This is, I guess, in response to Google saying that it had 34 cities in 9 metro areas that it was planning to bring Google fiber gigabit internet to. AT&T is saying, yeah, we could do that too. We might.
we could.
You could get it.
But we won't.
And so I don't know if or when they will, but if you live around Atlanta, Augusta, Charlotte, Chicago, Cleveland, Fort Worth, Fort Lauderdale, Greensboro, Houston, Jacksonville, Kansas City, Los Angeles, Miami, Nashville, Oakland, Orlando, San Antonio, San Diego, St. Louis, San Francisco, or San Jose, you might luck out in 2014 or 2015 and get gigabit Ethernet from AT&T and possibly Google Fiber right behind it.
And we've talked about it before. Neil Young's Pono Player has passed its Kickstarter with flying colors. They've raised $6.2 million, which is a ton more than they were asking for. So this is going to be a product in real life, assuming they take the money and do what they say they're going to do with it. And there's been some controversy in the industry, because there's a audio codec expert who also posted an article, and I tend to agree with this guy, saying that 24-bit 192 kilohertz music is complete nonsense, and it's too much quality for any human to hear, even in a perfect room with perfect speakers. So it's just beyond our human hearing capabilities to have that kind of quality of music. So let alone the fact that most people are walking around with crappy earbuds in their ears, and those people really aren't going to be able to tell a difference. But there remains a lot of interest in this device, and I'm sure it'll come out and people will say they can tell the difference, whether they can or not. And it'll be interesting to see if it sells a lot of units, as it is kind of a niche product, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that Neil Young would say he can tell the difference even if he can't either. And he's probably heard this argument before, and he probably doesn't care.
Also, he's got old ears at this point.
Yeah, probably half deaf.
Yeah.
He plays a pretty loud guitar.
Not even that. I mean, your ears degrade over time. So, you know, maybe a baby could tell the difference with the Pono Player, but not anyone else. All right, that might be a slight hyperbole.
I'm not sure a baby is going to appreciate Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young at 24 bits.
We'll have to do some A/B testing on that.
Perhaps we will. Okay, Netflix announced in its letter to its shareholders that they will be raising the prices of their streaming-only plans for the first time since 2010. And they're going to be doing that within the next quarter, so 3 months or so. If you don't have Netflix and were thinking about getting it, you may want to lock yourself into the $7.99 per month rate before they raise it again. And finally, Apple TV got three more channels on it. That's History, A&E, and the Lifetime Networks, all American cable networks. And this seems to be the way that Apple TV is going, right? They've been talking for a long time about sort of adding a la carte cable options to the menus, and they're adding a lot of them pretty frequently at this point. Now, this is not good news for you at all if you have the first generation Apple TV, which has been unable to connect to Apple content or any of the new content since last week. Apparently, there are some server issues which have not been resolved, and Apple's made no comment.
Yeah, that first-gen Apple TV is pretty old at this point.
It came out in 2008.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if they're just kind of letting that go a little bit, or I guess a lot of it.
Right. Well, mine has already been repurposed into a Linux server.
Yes. Cool. All right, well, let's turn off the afterburners here, and you can undo your seatbelt and make a gin fizz as we get into the end user stories.
I don't know why you keep saying gin fizz. You know it's going to take me 2 full minutes to make it.
All right, so I wanted to lead off this week with some experience I've gotten recently trying to find the perfect Bluetooth earphones. I know we've talked about this before. Previously, I had that, what was it, the M-Pow headset that we talked about. So I've tried a couple other solutions. I've got one. I got one device called the Jabra Stone 3, and this was an interesting device. It's a single ear mono headset that can do stereo streaming, similar to the one that we talked about previously. And it was a little strange in that it had this little charging base, and you would charge the base, and it has a battery in it. And the headset by itself got 2 hours of battery life, or somewhere thereabouts. And in conjunction with the charger, it would get 10 hours.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah, I'd never seen something quite like that.
And then how do you plug the charger in?
Right, so you have the little stone, as it were, and you plug that into a micro USB.
Uh-huh.
It has the battery inside of it. And then the headset snaps into the stone.
So has that been a good feature for you? Do you like the stone and having it charged, or did you wish you had more than 2 hours in the headset itself?
Yeah, honestly, 2 hours is pretty slim pickings for battery life. You know, it's not completely crazy that you would listen to a podcast for more than 2 hours in the course of a day, right?
Completely crazy to me. No, not at all. I mean, there are plenty of times where I would listen to more than 2 hours worth of podcasts.
Yes. Now, the other thing that I kind of find interesting is that I think the headset that I'm looking for doesn't exist for the moment, because this thing is really not designed for any kind of music or any kind of real quality audio. It's basically telephone audio coming out of this earpiece.
So it really lowers the quality, even if you're listening to a podcast. It's quite inferior to the original codec.
And podcasting would be barely acceptable. The audio quality on this device is not very good at all. So that was the downside. Now, the music was completely worthless on this headset. Again, it's a mono headset you put on one ear, so I kind of get it. But music, it was completely worthless for music. Huh? So don't pair it with your Pono player when you get that from the Kickstarter. So what was interesting about it was just the kind of form factor and the how small the earpiece was. That was kind of cool. But ultimately, it's $100, and I returned it because for that kind of device at $100, that's pretty stiff.
Yeah, you would want it to at least sound good.
Yes. So I tried one more, and they're called the Jaybird Blue Buds. And Taylor, these Bluetooth earphones blew me away. So what they are is, we've talked about these before. I think I had the Plantronics ones. They have the wire that goes around the back of your neck, and then they're just two earbuds, and that's pretty much all there is. But so in comparing these with the LG Tone headset that I have, which is the current recommendation from the Wirecutter, for example, these sound just as good as that headset did. So the form factor is a little slicker. You know, there's no band that goes around your neck.
Yeah, they look amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of wild, isn't it? And the I wouldn't imagine it would be very comfortable to go like running with these. But what I've ended up finding out is that they also come with this little ear stabilizer thing, and I found out that for at least just going around, walking around the city and the like, I don't actually need that. So again, these are also a little bit expensive, but I'm keeping these. They were like $130 for the pair. So for music and for podcasts, the sound quality on these is just about as good as anything I've seen on the market for Bluetooth earphones. So once my LG Tones give way, which they're about to, which is what set me off on this quest, I will be using these exclusively. So I'm very impressed by these headphones.
How long have you had the LG Tones?
So they're a handful of years at this point, like 3 years. They've lasted a long time for a consumer electronic product, right?
And why are they on their last legs? What's giving out?
So there's you know, you have this, the LG Tone has the band around your neck, and then you pull out the earbud out of the band and it goes into your ear. And the wire connecting the earbud to the neck band is starting to wear, I can see bare copper on it. So at any moment, those things are probably going to go away.
Well, it would be cheaper to fix that than to get new headphones.
That's true. That's true. But I don't know. I was looking for an alternative to see if there's anything good out there. And it turns out there was.
Yeah, it sounds like you found something pretty great.
And again, they're absurdly expensive, so I can't recommend that everybody get them. But for as much as I use Bluetooth earphones, I don't mind spending a little money on them. So anyway, success. I'm glad to report that I have some Bluetooth earphone success in that.
Yeah, these look really great. And so I'll be happy to hear how they turn out as you start using these over the LGs.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I can now say that I can recommend them both, too, because the LGs are also very, very good.
Awesome.
Okay, well, let's move into an article we've got here from The Verge, which I thought was a little curious. It's entitled The Plot to Kill the Password, and the gist of it, you know, to be fair, it's a full article. You should go read it if you're interested in the subject, but the gist of it is that we all know that passwords are horrible. And we want to move away from the passwords as a way to authenticate ourselves to websites. And the question is are biometrics the answer? Can we, with fingerprints and retina scans, do away with the password altogether, like we talked about with the iPhone 5S? And I think the answer to that, unfortunately, is no. I don't. There are ways of doing passwordless authentication. We've seen some experiments from, there's a company called Clef, which is experimenting with some key-based authentication. Steve Gibson from the Security Now podcast has been experimenting with his Squirrel project, which also has some key-based authentication. I think that will end up being closer to the solution than a fingerprint scanner will be. But it's good to have a fingerprint scanner as a second factor. It's not to say that it's not horrible for authentication, but it's just, I can't imagine that a fingerprint would be your only source of authentication. Solely for the fact that if somebody lops off your finger, they get access to everything. So I can't imagine that if you had data that you really wanted to be secure, that a finger scanner would be the option. Now, most people's data isn't really worth cutting a finger off, right? So, you know, maybe it makes sense for the James Bonds of the world, but for most people, I guess maybe it's okay. But we have solutions out there now that exist and are being created, and we can start to use those solutions instead of just going with fingerprints and retina scans. We have solutions for this, and we should start to deploy them into the real world.
Yeah, we absolutely should. And really, if you want your data in any form to be really secure, you can't secure it with just one form of security. So a password and a fingerprint or any combination of what you can do. If you have an iris scanner, okay, great. And, you know, maybe voice recognition, maybe some sort of token that you carry with you that changes a key that you have to spit in every time you log in. That's how Google Authenticator works. They give you a code that changes every 6 seconds, and you have to type in that code as it's given to you. But it seems to me that what Apple and Samsung and other companies as well are trying to do is not make it so that the fingerprint is your only form of verification, but that they're replacing the fingerprint with the password, or they're replacing the password with the fingerprint as your primary mode of identification, right? It's easier for someone to steal your password than your finger.
Yeah, that's true. I think you have to, the whole idea of having something you have and having something you know and combining the two is the way to be. If you're relying upon your fingerprint, you're relying upon two things that you have.
Sure, okay. I mean, it could be something that you know. The problem is that just about every single person in the world who knows their passwords aren't secure because they're reusing passwords. If you have perfectly secure different passwords for every site and service that you use, you're not going to be able to know them. And so that's just something that you have that can be stolen.
Right. So that's why I think a nice middle ground is having a key-based system where I create a key pair to log into a website. If you want more about that, there's Clef and Squirrel. You'd have to go into the nitty-gritty details about those two. But they seem to strike a balance of practicality and security in a way that kind of makes sense. And yeah, you're right. Having solely a fingerprint is perhaps a bad idea, but maybe we can combine some of these things.
The logical middle ground of security and practicality is very different from the actual middle ground that most end users end up using, which is way more towards practicality. People either use the same password for everything or they can't remember their passwords and it's constantly a problem for them. So if you could replace the password for those people with fingerprints, then you would in theory have better security with fewer problems, because there are a lot of problems with passwords these days. I mean, we spent all last week talking about it. Heartbleed lets people potentially get access to your password and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I guess you're right. For the majority of the people out there that don't use a password manager and that kind of thing, then maybe it does make a little sense. But I just think if you go look at these key-based systems, they're really impressive, and I think that that is the future.
And I have no doubt that they're very impressive, and that should be the future, but inferior technology wins out to superior technology all of the time.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it has often a great deal to do with market timing and convenience. And we are seeing the two biggest technology companies in the world today both pushing very hard for fingerprint technology to make the difference.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens in the end. And you're right, the superior technology doesn't always win. So we'll see if that catches on in a more general use case. You know, it's for now, it's you know, there's no website that you can log into with Touch ID, to my knowledge.
Right. It's all based on iPhone apps right now.
Right, on device.
But speaking of Apple and superior technology, they are the subject of my green tech story this week.
Cool. Let's get into it. What you got?
They have launched quite an initiative to explain and further their environmental campaign, starting with this video that you can see if you just go to apple.com right now. They're calling it the Better Campaign, and it's a video that shows some of the efforts that Apple is going through to make their technology more environmentally friendly at the same time as improving its performance. And the video is narrated by Tim Cook, and it's great. As far as corporate greenwashing propaganda goes, it's great. The video is just the introduction to several green tech initiatives that they are working on. First of all, they have made 120 U.S. Apple retail stores powered by entirely renewable sources. So this includes all of their flagship stores, like in Palo Alto, Chicago, and New York. And many other ones, basically everywhere where the municipality would let them do it, they've switched over to entirely renewable energy to power their stores. Another cool thing that they'll be doing at their retail stores is they are now accepting any Apple product from the company's history for free recycling. And when Apple says recycling, in this case, they mean actual environmentally responsible cycling. They are focusing on either reusing the products or breaking them down into their base components so that as much of each product can be recycled.
Wouldn't it be funny if somebody gave them like an Apple II?
I bet that somebody will. I bet there's a lot of broken Apple IIs out
there.
Oh,
man. And, those things belong in a museum at this point.
They will be breaking them down or perhaps putting them in a museum. I mean, Apple has left the door open for them to be able to reuse or resell products that people bring in for recycling.
Right.
So another thing that they're doing is they have been starting showing off their next generation data centers, which are largely powered by local renewable resources. They've set up their own banks of solar panels in many cases, particularly in the Nevada desert, which we have in this Wired article, which covers a lot of the things that they're doing for their data centers. And they're pointing out that all of their cloud computing and mass storage centers are 100% renewable energy, and in some cases energy positive. That is, they generate more energy through clean generation methods than they use. Now, this doesn't cover all of Apple's processes and facilities. A lot of their manufacturing, transport, and their products, which are largely assembled in China, are still using carbon positive manufacturing processes. But certainly in the U.S., they're doing everything that they possibly can. And this campaign that they've started is pushing that even further. And the final thing that they are working on right now is going to be their new Cupertino campus, Campus 2, which is a giant futuristic office building. They've now started to identify the environmental details that this new campus is going to have when it opens. And so they have a video that's available with some words from the architect Norman Foster about some of the things that they're doing for that building, which most of us will likely never see.
Yeah, it's cool to see Apple do some of this stuff. It's traditionally not something that some of these larger tech companies really care about. But I figure some combination of the Apple ethics and the money sense of Apple, somewhere between those two things, I think it makes a little bit of sense. So it's good to see them do some of this stuff.
Yeah. And I'd also like to point out that as part of Apple's recycling initiative, they will occasionally been doing drives where they will accept any consumer electronic technology, even from other companies, and recycle them as efficiently as possible.
All right, well, let's move on to the tip of the week, I suppose. Again, you have us covered, although you've got a Windows tip for us, oddly enough. What's going on here?
Yeah, this was great. You were telling me that you knew about this ahead of time, but I didn't learn about it until I read it on Lifehacker today. And apparently Windows 8 allows you to create a certified flash drive that you can boot onto any computer running your own custom version of Windows. And it's called Windows to Go.
Yeah, this is something that they just, if I remember right, they rolled it out with Windows 8 for the first time. And previously there were ways to do it. They were kind of hackarounds to allow you to do such a thing. But now it's kind of first party and supported, as it were. So strikes me as a great way for somebody not unlike yourself that has a Mac and boots into Windows once a year or something to just leave that Windows installation on a USB device off in the corner and then only use it when you actually need it. That seems like a pretty good way of going about doing it without messing with virtual machines and boot camp and that kind of thing. It seems pretty neat.
Right. Now, this Windows to Go feature is only available on the Enterprise edition of Windows 8, and you also need a Microsoft certified flash drive. So the tip of the week this week is actually a third-party tool called Win2USB that can do it whether or not you have the Enterprise edition or a Microsoft certified flash disk.
So yeah, so that's it's a pretty cool option. So we've also got an exciting app pick of the week. We've got Trim on the Mac. What is this?
Yeah, that's great. So ever since Apple started selling computers with solid-state drives in them, they have officially supported Trim, which is an algorithm that automatically cleans up old data blocks on solid-state drives to make it move a little bit faster. It takes advantage of idle time on the computer to clean up things on the hard drive. However, Apple computers only support trim functionality out of the box for hard drives that were sold by Apple, and you can only buy them in pre-built Apple computers. So if you have a third-party solid-state drive, like I do, or even one that Apple sells but didn't sign because you bought it independently, you couldn't enable trim on your solid-state drive. So I found this week a third-party program called Chameleon that can enable trim on third-party solid-state drives on any Mac.
Yeah, that's definitely something you want if you have an SSD in there. So that's a pretty cool little app to enable that kind of functionality. You definitely want that. So it's a shame that Apple doesn't really provide a first-party solution for that. But if Apple fails to do it, then there's somebody in the community that will. So that's what this app is. So it's good to see.
Right. So Apple has a first-party solution, but only for first-party drives.
Only for first-party drives.
So this is a third-party solution for third-party drives.
Right. All right. Well, let's get into our kicker this week. We have found, apparently, or at least I should say NASA's Kepler mission has found a planet that is very Earth-like and is going to be a candidate, I'm sure, for some of the first Earth-like planets that we've seen in the nearby galaxy. So this planet is named 186F, and it orbits a red dwarf, and it's about 10% larger than the Earth, but it is officially, albeit on the outside of the Goldilocks zone. So it is just barely inside the Goldilocks zone in that there should be liquid water on this planet if there is water on the planet at all.
It has the energy and atmospheric conditions to possibly support liquid water. If there is water on the planet, some of it is most likely liquid.
Yeah.
Now, the Kepler mission is a space telescope in orbit around the Earth, and it monitors thousands of stars simultaneously, watching them for slight dips in brightness, which indicate a planet crossing the plane of its path in the orbit around the star, between the star and the Kepler telescope.
And so-called transit in this case.
So it's been monitoring a certain section of the sky for weeks or months, I don't know how long, and then that information gets transmitted back to the Earth, and the data is eventually analyzed. And so they announce these exoplanet discoveries in batches. So the most recent batch was about 700 planets, and one of them just happened to be the most Earth-like planet that we've ever found. And so it's a little bit bigger than the Earth. It orbits a star that's much smaller, and it's a little bit farther away in terms of the energy that it receives from its star. But this is definitely a planet that could potentially support water, liquid water, which is necessary for life as we know it.
Okay, so when is SpaceX planning the road trip?
You'd have to talk to Elon Musk about that. But probably pretty soon. I think he's mentioned he wants to retire on a different planet.
Yeah, this is going to be a candidate for that. You know, I'm sure we'll find more of these things. But this is going to be one of the first candidates that we've seen for actually putting something down on the planet and seeing if that can indeed support life of some kind.
Right. Well, it's about 500 light years away.
It's going to take a while.
Yeah, we don't really have the energy to get there in any amount of time that we can figure out, but we're working on that too. So now we have a potential target. So that's something.
Yeah, no, all you have to do is give the navigator some spice, and he will make the proper calculations and fold space, and we'll get there. So don't worry about it. We got this.
and a new European extremely large telescope. That is the name of it, the Extremely Large Telescope.
Nice.
Being built on top of a mountain in Chile. And this telescope's job will, it will be the first telescope made by humans that will be able to directly observe planets in other systems. And I expect that Kepler-186f will be one of its first targets.
Yeah, that's going to be of extreme interest for sure. All right, well, I think it's time to get out of here for this week. Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you on the internet somehow, perhaps using space folding techniques, how would they go about doing this?
Oh, boy. Well, if they have space folding techniques, definitely tweet me about it. That's at TaylorPhone. That's my handle on Twitter. But I definitely want to hear about your space folding techniques. And let's go visit Kepler-186f together.
If you want to get at me, I also have my Twitter account. It's at Chris Hailbarn. So give us a tweet. Let us know what you think of the show. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. Have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got our email, theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together we are at theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mott.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
So who do you know that can fold space?
The Navigators.
Caracas. Always a problem.
The spice must flow.